Hey everyone, it's Jenny Nash, founder and CEO of Author Accelerator, the company I started more than 10 years ago to lead the emerging book coaching industry. In October, we'll be enrolling a new cohort of certification students who will be going through programs in either fiction, nonfiction, or memoir, and learning the editorial, emotional, and entrepreneurial skills that you need to be a successful book coach. If you've been curious about book coaching and thinking that it might be something you want to do for your next career move, I'd love to teach you more about it. You can go to bookcoaches.com/waitlist to check out a free training I have. That's bookcoaches.com/waitlist. The training is all about how to make money, meaning, and joy out of serving writers. Fall is always a great time to start something new. So if you're feeling called to do this, go check out our training and see if this might be right for you. We'd love to have you join us.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia,
and
this is #MWriting, the weekly podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, pitches, proposals, fiction, nonfiction. We're the podcast about getting things done, and I'm going to be solo this week because I am interviewing, and I'm so excited to interview, one Allie Carter, whose name, I'm stealing this from her bio because it was such a great line, is synonymous with hilarious action and heart-pounding romance. And as someone who's read much of it, I can vouch, kids. So Allie's most recent big book that you've probably seen around was The Blonde Identity. Her current book that you're going to want to go straight out and grab is The Blonde Who Came In From the Cold. And her other book that she wrote just for me, because it was like exactly what I needed a book in that moment, and I really appreciate it. I'm glad other people got to read it, but it was really for me, The Most Wonderful Crime of the Year. Those are her adult books. She's got a ton of young adult books, also with heart-pounding action and hilarious. Wait, heart-pounding romance, hilarious action. I feel those are exchangeable. And even some middle grade, if you've got some kids who might be reading in those lines. So Allie does all the things, and we're going to find out how and immediately be able to do it ourselves. Huh. Allie, thanks for coming.
Thank you so much for having me, KJ. I appreciate it.
I also wrote
The Most Wonderful Crime just for me, because it's that's like I love a mystery and I pick them up and I'm like, this would be great. Where's the romance? And then I love a romance and I pick it up and I'm like, where's the mystery? And so that's how Most Wonderful Crime came to be. Is
also
two great
it's
genres
writers
that are together.
Like writers in a mansion with secrets and surprise identities and like things people can do that no one knows they do can do, which is my jam. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
So, thank you.
Thank you for that. Not that I didn't. I love The Blonde Identity. My daughter has it right now and she's super excited because I can give her The Blonde Who Came In For the Cold early because I might have gotten an early copy. So she'll be reading that on the beach next week after she finishes the first one.
That is some good, cool mom points right there.
Well, it is. Yeah. And they're rare. But that is a great thing about my daughter is 21 and my other daughter is 19. So they're older, but I would have given the Blonde books and The Most Wonderful Crime to, you know, a 16, 15. Like they're not that I don't actually give some pretty steamy stuff to my kids, but if you're not somebody who does that, they're steamy, but they're not. Anyway,
yeah, there are books that like grandma and mom and daughter can all read together.
Yeah, I was just going to say I would give them to my mom, too.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just super fun.
Because sometimes the better test is not would I give it to my daughter, it's would I give it to my mom. You're exactly right.
Agreed. So my first question is this. How dare you? Okay, and now you're like, wait, what? No, seriously, like your books are, the plots are so out there and glorious and outrageous, and the action scenes are wild, and they're sort of everything you fantasize about in a spy romance novel. And as a former journalist, I spend a lot of time sitting around staring at my plot thinking things like, yes, but how would this person have health insurance? And I feel like you've transcended that. So can you talk to me and all of us about how you've, you know, embraced this world of the wild, glorious, fun, and outrageous in your plotting?
You know, thank you, first of all. That's a lovely compliment. I really credit it toward, you know, how most things are in my life and my career. It was total accident and sheer dumb luck. So 20 years ago, I realized not long ago, like literally 20 years ago this spring, I sold I'd Tell You I Love You, But Then I'd Have to Kill You. And I was, you know, big dumb kid, didn't know what I was doing, sheer dumb luck, had this amazing idea. And most of all, I had an amazing idea at a time when the YA genre was just expanding exponentially. Like the shelf space at Barnes & Noble was getting bigger mm-hmm. and bigger and bigger. And so it was a big tent and there was room for everybody. And so I was lucky in that I got in there. I was especially lucky because I had a brilliant editor named Donna Bray. And Donna could see like the shift coming, like she could see Twilight and the move wow. to paranormal and the move to, you know, moving away from contemporary fiction to genre fiction. And she was like, we have to get this out fast. And so we crashed it. And so I sold it in like April or May of 2005. Mm-hmm. And then it had to go to copy editing in October, and I had 32 pages.
Sorry.
And a day job.
Oh my goodness.
And so I had the summer of absolute deadline. I would come home from my day job, I would eat a fast dinner, and I would write till midnight. But this was also back like before we really had smartphones in our pockets all the time, definitely pre like social media. And so that's what you did. And I'm like, man, if I did that every day, think about how much writing I would get done today.
Yeah.
But because I was so fast, the turnaround there was so fast, I didn't have time to like go down a rabbit hole of, well, exactly what type of nylon cord would they use to rappel into such and such. You know, I made it up mm-hmm. and I got away with it. And so I realized that, you know, I did do a lot of research on actual trade craft.
Right.
So the things like there's a scene where the girls have to go through the boys' garbage. And there are scenes where they're, you know, planting bugs and those types of things. Those I watched documentaries. I read a lot of like actual decommissioned sort of old CIA handbooks and things. The International mm-hmm. Spy Museum has a wonderful reference section, and you can actually order like World War II training manuals and things. It's really great.
I did not know that.
So I did do that. What I did not do was I didn't worry about like the brand name of whatchamacallit. So as a general rule, I tell my readers, like, the more specific something is in the book, the more likely it is I made it up. So when I'm like, well, then she did the Wendetsky maneuver. And like, I don't know what the Wendetsky maneuver is, but they don't either. I made it up. But the actual sort of bones of what the school would teach and how they would teach it was mm-hmm. very accurate.
Mm-hmm. Well, it must have come in handy because you have another school in the current book.
Yeah. And it was a little harder because it is... you know, it's not for kids. And so it has to have a little bit more of an air of sophistication. And I wanted to base it off of the actual CIA training facility, the farm, which mm-hmm. is at Camp Perry, which is in the book. What I couldn't figure out were things like, do they sleep in apartments? Do they have a dorm? Are there barracks? Are there, you know, is there like a big cafeteria? Are they,
very few people will know what's real and they exactly. can't tell you, right?
They can't tell me. And so I actually, when I was on tour for Blonde Identity, I was in DC and I did a wonderful event and had hundreds of readers there. And they were like my Gallagher girls who had grown up. And they all are spies. I mean, they like literally work for the CIA. They're literally with, I'm with Homeland Security. Several of them were like, I can't actually tell you where I work, but you were very popular there. And I actually did a like show of hands, like, if you can say so, how many of you have been to the farm? And like multiple hands went up.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I'm like, we're talking when this is finished. And so... So I got a little bit, but not very much, you know.
Right.
And I guess the thing also with the farm is, you know, they bring in like their actual undercover operatives to train there, but there are a lot of different groups that also use that facility. So, for example, I think I'm not dreaming this. I think this is true. Like if you are an ambassador or an ambassador's family and you are going, maybe not like the ambassador to London, but if you're going to like, you know, someplace that could be a little bit dangerous, they'll send you there for like evasive driving training and things like that. So you get a little bit of training. So it's not just spies who train at Camp Perry. It's multiple groups.
I have a new life goal now, which is to never need evasive driving training.
Right. And see, I kind of want to learn how to do it. I don't want to need it, but I want to know how to do it.
No, it's not to need it. I don't want to need it.
I want to know how to do it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you could use it. your books inspire the writer in me to remember, like you said, that very few people care what brand of nylon rope you would use to rappel. And from there, it's a pretty short step to, you know, whether or not you can really stop a cable car halfway.
The way I see it is if you are the person who knows what brand of rope it is, there,
you're either
get the
not
rope
reading
right,
this
I'm getting
or
everything
you don't
else
care.
Wrong.
Yeah.
Like, there. This is not for them probably.
No. Or if it and, is, it they've yeah.
they're
there. Like
they're
like,
buying
that's
in or you're out.
Yeah.
And that's fine. And nothing but respect to the people who do know that. Because now I grew up on a farm and so I can't read like cowboy books. Because I'm like, oh gosh, geez Louise, of course barn burned down. You put that hay in there way too soon. Are you really
they're literally
green hay?
Haying my field like, right now.
Right. You know, I'm like, seriously,
yeah.
This is,
same.
You know, you're not, you didn't do a semen test on your bull. Like,
right.
You know,
you
I,
are
I'm
not
just, like,
milking
throwing out
that
my
cow.
Hands and so,
I know how you're supposed to hold your hands. And
exactly,
that's not
I just,
it.
Yeah. I'm not here for. And so I'm like, this is the same thing. Like spies have no reason be reading me. I have no reason reading the things that I do know about because it's, you know, it's just. It's not exciting to me. And so I'm sure most spies, you know, there's a line in.
Yeah, it's not a fantasy. It's,
yeah.
It's, so it can't be a fantasy because you're too stuck on, you know.
Exactly. And so.
The reality that our hay baling chute is broken and therefore we will need multiple people tomorrow to go around and pick up each individual bale and put it on a flatbed truck. And drive it to the barn and take each individual bale off the flatbed truck and then stack them in the barn. Y'all are missing my arm gestures, but Allie knows of which I speak.
I know those gestures. You got to buck it up with your knee. It is not easy work.
No.
And it is very hard work.
Yeah.
And
I'm hoping not to go out there, but I know I will.
Oh, no, you don't want to do that. And you will itch for
I've
days.
Done it. I've done it for years.
Yeah.
And I know I'm going to end up there. Oh, it's my birthday tomorrow, too.
Oh, no, that's not.
Maybe not.
I think it's very easy also when reading as a reader, I hate it when it's very clear that a author has done a ton of research and they're not going to let it go to waste.
Yeah. Couldn't
and so
help
there's
but
like,
put it
you know, they'll
there.
Introduce the thing and then they'll have like a paragraph explaining all of the things that they have learned. And I'm like, this serves no purpose whatsoever.
No. Y'all can thank my editor for my leaving out the entire history of Prohibition era alcohol rules between Kansas and Missouri and the Chicken Sisters.
Yep. See, if you want to write that, the nonfiction is right there. You can, you've got it.
Yeah.
And so I like to do enough research to inform the story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are definitely things, you know, scenes and lines and wonderful things that have come from the research. But I never do research just so I know, again, like what kind of rope it is.
Right.
I think then also, are you doing research or are you procrastinating?
Well,
because I think most people, it's just procrastinating.
We all know the answer to that.
We all know the
answer to that. So how about the action scenes? You write such great action scenes, but I am also not a reader who's like picturing, well, clearly at this point he's upside down and her hand, you know, that's not how I read anything. I just kind of go zoop through that. So how do you handle writing them? Are you like slowing down action films so you can...
dissect the movements?
I really don't like writing action scenes. They are hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like I've done everything. Like, they're okay. Well, hey, here we are. We're doing that again. But they come with the job. And so I think most of all, you just have to remember sort of the blocking of it. Like, okay, who is where? The other hard thing that comes, and, you know, movies have it so much easier. Like, you don't need a name for the six bad guys that Black Widow.
Right. Or the one on the right and the one behind. Yeah. Yeah. No.
And so I'm like, okay, but how is the reader keeping these different? So, you know, like, well, one of them has glasses and the other one has a goatee. Okay. Right. Well, then from that point forward, I, the author, just call them glasses and goatee.
Right.
And so you have to remember, like, okay, glasses is down, goatee's still at large, you know, or whatever.
And is there a special copy editor for that?
They're not special, but that is definitely can fall into a copy editor's purview, especially things like during that fight sequence. Okay, well, it was 100 pages ago, but it was also yesterday that your heroine got shot. Is she really fighting at full strength?
Oh, ouch.
You know, so that type of thing, because again, reader wise, that was the midpoint. I'm to the climax now. But timeline wise, no, that was yesterday.
Right.
And so
with some readers, reader-wise, that was an hour ago.
Yeah.
I mean, so, you know, we're eating this up.
Exactly.
It's a lot faster to read than to write.
Think about those types of things. Like, I wrote that 2 months ago, but nope, it's still right there.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing that, you know, again, you can't really worry about in a first draft. Like, let that's future use problem.
Yeah. Now, in contrast to, you know, the wild plotting and the crazy, enjoyable, delicious action, your people feel, you know, super, super real. They have big reasons for being the way that they are, but the feelings feel real. I think that is an amazing contrast. Do you start with you know, the person's flaw, or what it would, there's some term of art for this, which I have forgotten. Or do you start with, I need a person who, or does it vary book by book?
Thank you. I spend a lot of time with that.
That's why they work.
Thank you.
No, seriously. No one, I mean, the blonde identity would maybe be fun if it wasn't also like you really want her to figure out who she is and you really want to know why is this happening and what is up with, and like, you want all that for the character. You believe in her.
And that's always, I find, as much about tone as anything. This particular subgenre, it can go wacky or kooky really fast.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's very easy. You know, I like to say that spy movies exist on a spectrum that range from Get Smart to Zero Dark Thirty.
Yeah.
Anything along that spectrum is a spy movie. But those could not be more different. And so are we doing like James Bond, like he's cool and suave, but he also has gadgets? Or are we doing like he's, you know, kind of bumbling with gadgets? Or are we doing, it's very realistic.
Well, are we doing Roger Moore James Bond? Or are we doing guy who now models for, thank you, Loewe.
Yeah.
Exactly. Daniel Craig, which are very different James Bonds, really.
Very different James Bonds, because I've heard people, the James Bond people talk about, the Daniel Craig James Bond doesn't exist without Jason Bourne.
You know,
that's who they looked at. And so all of these things, you know, and so when I'm trying to figure it out, and I think that's one of the hardest things about a genre bending romance, whether you're bending fantasy and romance or horror and romance or romance and mystery or romance and action or whatever, you can only really write in the Venn diagram space where there's overlap.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't, you know, the realistic version of this is not something where people are falling in love. Like, it's, you know, it's too dark, and it's definitely not a comedy. It's definitely not a comedy. So you have to find the place where, no, they're in real actual peril. This is really terrible. This is, they're really might die.
And they understand that.
And they understand that. They get that. Also, but they still have time to, you know, okay, well, now I'm going to, you know, now we're going to slow dance. You know, you still have to find those times. And the other thing is, you know, you have to figure out just where on the spectrum you want to be. And lean into that. Like, if you want to write like the kooky sort of Agent Cody Banks of it all, then you have to do that. But then you have to realize the other parts of the spy kind of world that you can't touch. And so you're always threading needles. It is a task of absolutely threading needles all the time.
I think that, yeah, when it comes to tone, where on the spectrum do you want to be is like maybe one of the greatest questions that I have heard. And it's just one that, I think we all wrestle with.
And I've had people that really don't, people who should get it, who don't get it. So, I was in a meeting one time with some Hollywood producers who were looking at some of my stuff. And I said, well, tonally, where do you want it to be? And they were like, what do you mean? And I said, well, do you want it to be like, Mr. and Mrs. Smith or Bourne Identity? And they said, well, those are the same thing. And I was like,
No.
Meeting is over. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I don't understand how people don't get that. But to me, I spend 90% of my time worried about it. Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember now what I was going to say earlier. I got my start, and I'm never going to be like a full-time or big time of this, but I've done some screenwriting. And so there's a screenwriting podcast by two guys who are very big, very dominant screenwriters. One of them did like the Charlie's Angels movies and the Aladdin remake and all those. The other one does The Last of Us and a bunch of big like HBO shows. And they always talk about the want song. So in every Disney musical, the first song sets up the world. It's Belle, wandering through town. The second song is the whatever she wants. And so, Moana, see the line where the sky and the sea meet, it calls me. Like Moana wants to travel. She wants adventure. And so I spend a lot of time when I'm setting up these characters thinking about what their want song would be.
Mm.
And so like for Most Wonderful Crime of the Year, her want song is I want to be Eleanor.
Right.
She wants to be Eleanor Ashley, who is my like fake off-brand Agatha Christie. And so that's what you have to think about a lot. Like, what Alex wants is to sort of be free. Like she wants to be enough. She wants to pay her, she has paid her debt for, sort of having been born strong and healthy, where her identical twin has been born very, very sick. And so she wants to never lay eyes on Michael Kingsley ever again, who was her, on and again, off again partner / love interest. And so that's, I always start with that. What is their wound? What is the thing that hurt them in the past that they're trying to get over? And what is their want?
Yeah.
And almost always what they realize over the course of the book is that the thing that they want is not the thing that they need.
Yeah.
And so that's an Allie Carter book. That's an Allie Carter character progress.
That's it. Now everyone can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, but if it were that easy, everyone would do it. Right. This is amazing and delightful. I hope really helpful for people. I got distracted by taking some notes on what you just said. So people, for me, for the Post-its on my computer, oh my gosh, so many Post-its. So many Post-its. Let's talk just a little bit about the difference between YA and adult, when you're fundamentally, some people sort of switch genres entirely. Mm-hmm. You are writing very similarly toned books for different audiences. How do you think of that evolution?
That's, in a way, yes, I did switch audiences. And in another way, they're the exact same readers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an interesting and weird thing about YA is about every 3 years, you have to make all new readers because they have grown up and they've aged out of you. And even if they haven't aged out of you, they have what I call cooled out of you.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, I liked those books when I was a little kid. And so current me can't possibly like those books because those are little kid books. And so I was on the phone during the pandemic with my friend Rachel Hawkins, and Rachel had written YA for a long time, and then she switched to adult. And I was talking about, like, I need to sell something. Do I sell another middle grade? Do I sell a YA? Like, what do I sell? And she says, you sell an adult. You sell an adult book that appeals to your Gallagher Girl readers. And I said, oh, Rachel, I've spent, 15 years building a career in YA. I've got, and she said, your readers aren't there anymore. They are the girls who read you when they were 12, 10 years ago are 22 now.
Mm.
And I'm like, oh, that's right. They are. They've grown up. And so I had the idea for the Spy Twins. And had tried to do it as YA. And then at one point, I even tried to do it as middle grade. And I could never make it work. And the problem wasn't one of the twins wakes up with amnesia and somebody's trying to kill her. That I could pull off. The problem was, how and why is her identical twin on the run? And what does she have? And, like, she needs a longer
history than you can have as a teenager.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, is she actually working for the CIA? Yeah. Like, yeah. Because then again, we get into Agent Cody Banks territory. Then it's, we've got a super secret branch of the CIA who recruits kids. I'm like, no, you don't. Right. That's stupid. Yeah. Like,
she's been there since she was 10 and now she's on the lam.
Exactly.
And then at age 12, she went rogue. Yeah.
And then you've got it's a parent trap situation, and one of them was raised by a spy and one of them was raised by ordinary people. I'm like, oh, well, maybe, I don't know. But, I just couldn't quite make it work. And so I was talking to Rachel and I said, what am I supposed to do? Just dust off that old spy twin idea, except now instead of a super secret organization, she's just on the run from the CIA. And then I was like, wait a second.
Well,
she's 30. She can. So every single problem and logic challenge that I had with that premise went away once those characters became 30. And so it was the easiest writing I've ever done. I feel almost guilty about how easy that book was to write, because I'd been working at it and hammering at that idea for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so it was almost like, instead of starting it at the beginning, I started it at the end of the writing process, where you have that one like little linchpin thing that you think, oh, but what if I do this? And then the whole plot just, I started it there. I started it at the domino moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm spoiled because it'll never be that easy again. But that's how the transition went. And, it's been great because my readers, they're so excited to see me. It's like, I hear from readers all the time. They're like, it feels like you wrote this just for me. I grew up with you and now you're writing books for me again. And that has been very full circle and very, very fulfilling.
That's great. Well, you're writing them for me too. So love that. And I think for a lot of our listeners who I really think are going to enjoy this episode. So before I let you go, can I ask you what you have read and loved lately?
Oh, sweet mercy. I have been so underwater on a book, and it's been the kind of deadline and the kind of book, the old adage is so true that you never learn how to write a book. You just learn how to write the book you're writing right now.
Yeah.
And so this one has just, and when I get that way, I don't enjoy reading because my inner critic can't turn off. But I will share a show that I loved, and they just announced that they're not doing a season 2, and I'm heartbroken over it.
Oh.
But on Netflix, there's a Shonda Rhimes show called The Residence. And it's a murder mystery set at the White House. Somebody drops dead during a state dinner. And it's got kind of a kooky detective and a wonderful, colorful cast. And it's very, very funny. But it also, it threads that tonal needle. We're like, no, there was a murder. This is still serious. But, oh, by the way, I'm going to go look at the body. But first, I saw a bird I want to check out. And so it's just tonally and voice-wise, it does really amazing things. And so if any of your listeners are looking for a really great, like, 8-episode series, it's great. I could not recommend it more. The Residence on Netflix.
That sounds super fun. Well, I am in midst of The Blonde Who Came In from the Cold. So, I don't normally recommend a book until I know if the writer's going to stick a landing, but I feel quite confident in this one, and have enjoyed, as you can obviously hear from the podcast, the rest of Allie's work. So I'm going to just push all of you listeners to, head out there, grab the new one, grab the old one, and have a good time with them.
Aw, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for being here. Oh, should people follow you on social media? Do you do anything fun? Are you?
I do nothing fun. I'm not fun at all. I'm mostly on Instagram, I guess, at this point. I'm the Allie Carter over there. I have a couple of kind of defunct Facebook pages that I update occasionally. I just updated it for the first time, evidently, in 2 years. So that was fun. I'm on Threads very seldom. I used to be on Twitter. I still have that account. I don't update it very often. But yeah, and of course my newsletter. Like the newsletter is, I think we need to come back. We all need to get back to the newsletter because it will deliver the news directly to your inbox. And so if you want to make sure you don't miss any, like, you know, tour events, which by the way, I'm coming to Boston on tour in a couple of weeks. So looking forward to that a lot. Is it Lovestruck Books? Is that Boston?
Probably. Yeah. That's the new romance bookstore there. Yeah. I've been with Serena a couple of times. And yeah, it is a beautiful store. Like every detail thought, their bathrooms are phenomenal. That's how wonderful this store is. So very cool. All right. I will link up the newsletter in the show notes. And yeah, about, you know, once every week, I decide to just cancel all the rest of my social media and only do my am reading email. And then I imagine what my agent would say. And
yeah, you know, exactly. You know, and I feel like I'm such a broken record, like, oh, you know, go buy my book. Oh, go, you know, I'm going to be here on tour. Oh, this is how you get signed books. And I just say it over and over and over again. And then inevitably, and this really happened to me one time. I was sitting at the LAX airport waiting on a flight home. And I got an irate message from a reader that I'd never come to LA. And I was like, I did an event here last night. Like I was at the Barnes & Noble at the Grove or wherever last night. And so it feels like we are just beating a dead horse, letting people know about these things, but it's so easy for things to get lost. And so, yes.
Yeah. Jess tells a story. That's one of my other co-hosts about, you know, someone who had come up to her, what really one of her biggest fans, good, you know, book, and I get your, you know, I love this, and I love that you wrote, like, knew a lot. And then she said, oh, well, did you enjoy my latest book? And they're like, you have a new book?
Right. It happens every time. And so, you know, it's just part of the business at this point.
It's part of the business. All right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
As always, listeners, until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.